Hey, welcome to episode 5 of Salmena's Not Yet Named Podcast. If you guys listen close during this episode, you might hear a little Easter egg of what the show might be called, but we're not worried about that right now. What we're worried about is who we're joined with today, and that's with award-winning sommelier Ted Ross. Gonna talk about wine today and what it takes to be a sommelier and how he got into the wine game and some of the nuances of what it takes to recommend great wines and recommend, you know, what to pair with those wines and what makes a great wine. So if you're into wine, which a lot of people are right now, and it's a booming industry, and who better to explain it to you and the ins and outs than an award-winning somm. I hope you guys enjoy the show, and if you do like it, don't forget to hit subscribe at iTunes, SoundCloud, or Stitcher. Thanks to everybody who's been listening so far. The best way to support this show is by leaving great comments and great reviews and 5-star wherever you guys do listen to it. And please go ahead, and if you see the links on social media, go ahead and share it, like it, comment on it. You know, if you guys want to comment, this month is Podcast Awareness Month or whatever the big thing is. So just share it and use the hashtag tripod when you guys do share that. And if you have people that don't know what podcasts are or how they work, I think they're great. I wouldn't be doing one if I didn't think they were a great medium. So while you guys do that, enjoy listening to Ted Ross. All right, let's do this. With me today is Ted Ross, and he's kind enough to have me in the pit.
The snake pit.
The snake pit at the bar, appropriately enough, sitting at the bar recording a podcast about wine, and we're drinking beer. But mm-hmm. Ted Ross, with apologies to the advocate, Paul Heyman, is the reigning, undisputed, defending, Our Detroit Magazine, 3-time running Sommelier of the Year. Ted, how are you?
Afternoon, Sal. How are you?
Great, great. Ted, how you been?
I've been good, thanks.
Yeah?
Yep.
So, I miss you. We worked together for about 3.5 years.
We did. I did a quick 10.
Quick 10 up in Chino.
It's like Shawshank.
Yeah, you got out through them sewer pipes.
Yep.
Yep. I miss.
Crawled through a sewer shit and came out clean on the other side.
Clean on the other side. Still looking for my rock wall box so we can meet in Mexico.
Say Wataneo, friends. Say Wataneo.
Ted, you're a certified sommelier.
Yes.
And that's got to be one of the coolest professions out there. Why wine? What got you into wine?
Well, you know, unique, not only beverage, but product in general. I think that, you know, the French talk about terroir, and terroir is what does a place taste like, right? Fine wine has a unique way of transporting the senses and really kind of just an escape, which is very cool. So I getting into wine, I didn't understand that in the beginning by any means. This is something that kind of came about as I've grown. It's really a very cool thing.
So you've grown into it. You've been doing it for how long? How long you been in the wine game? How long you been in that game?
I've been in the game since I was about 15.
15.
Yep. I started working in a wine shop, a very high-end, very fine wine shop in Bloomfield Hills where I grew up at the ripe old age of 15 years old.
What were you doing there? You weren't selling wine.
No. Pretty hard to do anything in a wine shop at that age besides just keep it clean, dust the floors, and dust the bottles, and just listen, really, you know. I saw a lot of cool things there and really piqued my interest, and you know, here I am today thanks to it. So
was it one of those, hey, you're 15, you need to get a job and get out of the house and stop playing Super Mario Brothers?
Sort of. It started off as a job at a caterer, actually a very high-end caterer, and this guy that I worked for, awesome guy, still know him to this day, closed down his kitchen shortly after I started to remodel. It was about a 3-month remodel and happened to be over the summertime while I was looking for employment, being a high school student. So worked there for a few months, and he decided it was time to remodel. So I walked over to the wine shop that we used to do some business with to tell the owner that I wouldn't be around for a few months and to thank him for all his antics and humor and all that when I went there and bought a soda at lunch. And he offered me a job to kind of keep me busy while the caterer was closed, and I ended up staying there for almost 10 years.
Wow.
So that's kind of
cool. I mean, to be in high school and hold on to a job for 10 years. When I was in high school, I remember working at, of course, you're bouncing around every store in the mall, and you're like, oh, my God, I've been here for 7 months. I need to get something else.
Right.
I need to work at American Eagle because that's where all the chicks are. And,
right.
Man, 10 years in a wine shop in Bloomfield, of all places.
And I was fortunate enough to do a lot of traveling. Tried to tie most of that into wine.
Traveling one when you were there, the other, working but, there?
Yeah.
Like with your family?
For in school with my family, whether it was in Europe, Germany, Italy, Austria, Switzerland, parts of Canada, the Finger Lakes, California, Washington, Oregon.
So,
Argentina,
for wine,
Chile, all that, yeah.
The passion for wine that runs through the family, then. That was something
that
you picked up from them.
Oh, very much so. Very much
so, yeah. That's awesome. It's great.
My mother's side, especially. First generation Italian on my mother's side. She moved here in 1972. And she was about, let me think, she was about 16 when she moved here, 17. And got to thank my nonno Aldo, Aldo Vitale, for the, you know, firsthand experience of watching home winemaking and drinking wine, you know, since I was a tiny little tyke. So that didn't hurt.
So that had to have been cool. I mean, when we hear people getting together to make the wine and everything, it's a big deal. I mean,
you had
to have multiple generations sitting there watching the tradition being passed down. And I mean, it's got to be, I haven't seen it myself, but it's just got to be something to say that you have all the generations learning all the old techniques and maybe the newer generation saying, oh, I saw this, maybe we can try it this way. Or was it mostly just shut up, it's my way or nothing?
Well, that's kind of how it came, and I wish I had a better answer because, unfortunately, I, you know, probably like most kids do, ignored most of it and just was in the environment sort of watching it secondhand. I wish I could redo all that in my life and really experience more of it, but it was definitely a full-bore
experience,
yeah.
Yeah, nice. So before you got into wine, you said you had mentioned to me earlier that you were carrying golf bags, and that just wasn't your gig.
Yeah, so my first sort of trial at employment was to be a golf caddy at the Bloomfield Hills Country Club, and I did that in, would have been eighth or ninth grade.
Wow. Young.
Yeah, I went through the training, the 1 week, 3 hours after school for 5 days training, and realized that I wanted nothing to do with that, so never went back. And then I think the following summer is when my mom and dad finally said, hey, you know, if you want to do anything sort of independently, it's time to get a job and figure out how to do it. So I went to the caterer, which led into the wine shop.
Led into the wine shop.
Very quickly.
So as you got into deeper in your 10 years at the wine shop, I'm sure obviously dusting bottles and mopping the floors and pricing stuff got into, you know, look over this order, check in this order, and as you became older and maybe learned more, you picked up more stuff.
And a lot of it was interacting with customers, really. We did a lot of custom cellar installations and deliveries like that. You know, it was a really, really high-end area and a high-end trade, so it wasn't unheard of for me to fit $50,000 worth of classified Bordeaux into the trunk of an Explorer and drive over to someone's house and neatly put it away in a little cabinet or into a wine cellar. And that kind of morphed into, hey, can I help you organize this, or can I help you do this or that? And one thing led to another, and I really, you know, along with my heritage, kind of the foundation of this really serious passion was laid. So
you've mentioned your heritage. You're partial to Italian wines then?
I'll say this about Italy, and this is all, wine is so subjective, and people ask me questions about what is the best, and what is this, and what is that, and I'll tell you what, there is no best. Wine is so individual and so personal. When we're talking about Italy, Italy to me is the most diverse wine-growing country on the planet. You know, you've got everything from these super cool climate, high alpine vineyards in the north, all the way down to the scorched, dry earth of Sicily and everything in between, right? Mm-hmm. So every sort of microclimate and varietal and style that you can ever think of, plus they've been making it there for how many thousands of years. So yeah, Italy is pretty much the bomb, if you ask me.
Would you call Italy the first?
A lot of lineage of grape varietals, if I'm not mistaken, trace back to the Middle East, actually. Not necessarily known for producing and drinking wine over there for obvious reasons.
Just obviously the civilization started over there.
But a lot of the genetics trace back to the Middle East, especially a region in Iran called Shiraz or Shiraz, right? So we credit that Shiraz or Syrah being a French genetics, but a lot of things point to the Middle East. And when you look at Italy, it's the same thing, right? Who, over the millennia, who's settled that little peninsula in the world? It was the Turks and the Ottomans and the Spaniards and the, you know, Arabs and the Mongols. Everyone's been there. Mm-hmm. So who knows? But I do know that, I mean, it for me, Italy is about the final frontier in terms of the great wines of the world, and a very, very, very close second place to that would be France.
And it's got to be the proximity. I mean, I'm assuming that the climate is the same. The soils and might be the same. Obviously, of course, southern Italy is going to have a different climate than France, just geographically speaking, but the methods and the growing methodology is probably about the same, or is it matter what grapes are grown
there? I'd say
they'd
be completely unique to every little tiny town in each huge country, right? I mean, they credit Italy for growing over 4,000 different varietals of grapes on its own. And I've done this for most of my entire life, and every day I hear about different grapes that I've never heard of. So it's one of those things where you can study your entire life, and the more you learn, the more you realize you don't know shit.
Right.
Right?
So, yeah, absolutely. Should be on a poster hanging
there
up somewhere.
There you go.
I love that.
There you go.
Can we take a picture of you after this and we'll market it? Your passion and your knowledge for wine, personally for me, and I'm sure for most others that know you, are unmatched by anybody else. You had to have taken, to be a certified sommelier, starting at 15 years old and then building your knowledge.
Yep.
How do you become a certified sommelier? What's the extra education that you have to take, and what helped you?
The certification comes through the Court of Master Sommeliers. I'm a certified sommelier, which means I've taken two exams with them. The first exam is an intro level exam. It takes about two and a half days. And then the second exam is about a full day. And once you complete that, you're considered a certified sommelier. And most of that, there's various parts of the exam, but part of it is a written exam. There's a short sort of theory exam, if you will. There's some blind tasting, and then there's some service, which basically how well you can run a dining room and service a table in a fine dining restaurant, which was by far the hardest part of that exam for me, because I've never worked in a restaurant in my life, and I really have no intentions of doing so. So I did that second exam back in 2009. So it's been a while, but the way I remember it, those were kind of the gist of the exam. So
I think about that, and you took this exam when?
2009.
So we're looking at about 8 years, call it.
Yeah.
And it's always evolving, and as you mentioned, every town, every region has their own varietal, has their own wine, has their own methodology. We talked, and you didn't want to talk about sports, which is fine, but I always relate... I'll relay everything into sports, where I look at the evolution of basketball, and in the 80s it was rough and tumble, and you had, you know, Magic and Bird, and then you got to the 90s when Jordan and had the Bad Boy Pistons, and then, you know, so the game was always evolving to what it is now. It's wide open, and teams are figuring out that, you know, oh, I'm going to shoot threes, and even if I shoot 50 of them a game, if I hit 10 of them, that's a bunch of extra points.
Yeah.
They're always studying. These coaches are always studying, and these athletes are always developing different ways. That's got to be similar to what you do, and you have to keep up a continuing education program.
For sure. Don't you want to ask me about, you know, who I associate myself with in the NBA? Or?
Well, yeah. I mean, to me,
because I'm Vinnie Johnson.
You play like the microwave.
I'm the microwave.
Aside from the rosy red cheeks right now, I don't see the other correlation.
Because I'm little and I heat up quick. That's why.
That's your boy.
I heat up quick.
Is that the extent of your sports knowledge?
That's about all I know. And I think he played basketball, right?
He did. He won a championship here, too, with the Pistons. Game-winning shot against Portland.
That's a microwave.
They make good wines in Portland.
Outside of Portland, there's a famous valley of the Willamette.
I love the wines from
the
there.
The Willamette, damn it.
The Pinot Noirs are
Salmanna.
Great there. That's for me.
Cool up there, baby.
Been
up there. I was up there in August.
Oh, recently.
Yeah.
Nice. So when you go out of state or out of country, and we'll get into it a little bit more, what do you look to do when you're out of state and out of the country? What's your objective when you're going to see these different vineyards or the different winemakers?
You can learn a lot of a region by its just talking to the locals. And you know, traveling is such an important part, I think, of everything in life, whether it's trying to be a somm or whatever you're doing. Travel is so damn important. Going to a place and just talking with locals and going to local places and kind of just seeing all that is, I would say, more valuable than anything. I mean, I think I know people that go out to, and we're not going to say any names or whatever, but people that go on vacation, let's say they go to Florida, and they go to Florida and they're there for a week and they eat at McDonald's and Applebee's and Tim Hortons and Buffalo Wild Wings, and then they go home and they were in Florida. Well,
were they?
What the hell did you really see and do in Florida besides see the sun? Which, yeah, exactly. So I really try to make it a point, and maybe I'm going out on a tangent, but I do not, as almost a rule, go to chains of any type. I try to support only local businesses, whether it's getting a coffee in the morning or it's having dinner at night.
Well, you're not experiencing the region.
Exactly.
You're not experiencing the taste of that area.
Yes.
You know, if you're in Detroit, you got to get a Coney. If you're in Chicago, you're getting
Thank
a deep dish.
Thank
if you're in, if you're
you.
In California, you're
Thank
getting In-N-Out burger.
Yes. So I'm not, you know, I take this as we're talking about wine or we're talking about life or whatever. I don't go to chains. If I go visit somewhere, whether it's for wine or vacation or what, I try to talk to locals and, first of all, visit a region like that. And then you can have a pretty damn good idea as to what to expect, I think, in terms of what they produce. If you go to anywhere worthwhile, anyway. So,
where are the coolest places you've been? And who are the coolest people you've ran into where wine has taken you? And not necessarily because you drank too much and it took you whatever, but you know what I mean.
I think the most beautiful and touching place to me that I've ever visited was Argentina. And it was pretty cool because flying there, I actually flew to Chile and then flew to Argentina and then came home. But flying down there, I thought I knew there was everything to know about Argentine wine. And it was all high elevation, dry farmed Malbec and kind of one dimensional. And that was it. And I was really proven wrong. I thought the people were, in general, to be the most genuine, beautiful, awesome, fun-loving people I've ever experienced anywhere in the world. I loved it there. But I mean, you know, Europe is so damn cool. The south of France, Tuscany, Sicily, it's every region is so cool. California is just amazing.
So California is so big, but it seems like that the most popular wines all come from the Napa Valley region. Am I wrong in saying that?
Yeah, I would say so. I think that people are quick to associate the Napa Valley as the
end all be all.
The end all be all of California, but that's not really necessarily the case. I mean, I think if you want expensive Cabernet Sauvignon, then yes, Napa Valley's your home and Sonoma's a close second when you're talking California. But California is very, very diverse, just like we were talking about Italy. I mean, from the far north to the south. There's a lot of different things going on in between those two, and a lot of land covered in between, so they can do a lot of cool stuff.
I had a guest on a couple of shows back, and we talked about the economy and the diversity of the economy in California. And
yeah.
People lament that the farmers are getting water for so cheap when they're getting yelled at for brushing their teeth. And I feel that between agriculture and wine, it's a huge part of California's economy. And it's important to have
most
that.
Definitely.
It's important to probably have that diversity north to south, as you said, to support not only the state but these farmers. And it's a delicate thing, these grapes and these vines, where they're so impacted by the weather that they're going to need all the help they have. So if that is extra water for these farmers, or if that is different regulations for these people growing these sensitive, delicate grapes to continue to generate revenue for the state, that's got to be a big deal. It's got to be something that's got to be supported.
Here's the cool thing about growing grapes and winemaking grapes specifically. You don't need a lot of water. That's the thing that a lot of people don't understand. When you have farmers that are, you know, the company that I work for, it really has none of this whatsoever, but farmers in the Central Valley of California, kind of the production capital of the state, where they have these vast miles of these valley floor vineyards that are farmed to produce thousands of tons an acre. It's quite different than growing grapes on a mountainside in Sonoma County or Napa, where, you know, 1.5 to 2 tons an acre is a lot. And grape vines are unique. I mean, winemaking grapes are unique in the fact that they're really one of the only agricultural product where you actually kind of neglect the vine or neglect the plant with the hopes of producing something superior. Right?
How so? Explain that.
So think about like planting champion heirloom tomatoes or apples on a rocky, windy, cold mountainside in Sonoma County with the hopes of getting anything back. You wouldn't do that. But with grapevines, the idea is, yeah, they're going to struggle and they're going to give you a minuscule amount of fruit, but the little bit of fruit they produce is the best.
So it's
super concentrated.
So it's not as delicate and sensitive as I'm making it out to be. They are pretty hardy. They are pretty resistant to the conditions.
The good ones are, for sure. That's the difference between fine wine and plunk. There's a lot that goes into that bottle of wine. People ask, why is this wine $30 and this one is $15? This one is $2. Well, you got to look at what's going into the bottle.
When you and I worked together, you were the wine director and the certified sommelier, and you'd have the salesman come in on particular days. And I was always fascinated was on the middle of the week when all your salesmen would come in and basically pitch their wines to you. And I was fully expecting
tote their wares, pimp their wares.
And at any given time, I was just waiting for the anchor from the different stations fighting each other with horses and
pitchforks. Ron Burgundy would show up.
Yeah, I was waiting for Ron Burgundy and Brick and Champ to show up. And you know, Brick killed a guy.
I did not know that.
He stabbed him in the heart with a trident. but it all seemed pretty cordial. Everybody seemed to get along, even though they were competing for shelf space.
Very, very minuscule amounts of shelf space.
Very
minuscule. It's a rat race every week for those guys. I do not, I feel sorry for those. I feel sorry for them.
So how cool is it for you to be pitched to and you get to taste all this great wine?
Sort of be the gatekeeper,
yeah,
if you will.
Yeah.
You know, it's really fun to, being a buyer is a great position. It's not perfect, but there are definitely perks to that position. I tried to run that department as if I was a judge, you know. And just be very fair about it and let the wine speak for itself because, you know, a salesman's job is to become friends with you and, you know, almost put the product to the side and sell their personality. And my salesmen were very good at that. And if you're not a good buyer, before you know it, you've got way too much product from all of your friends, and you've got no budget, and you're done. So just trying to let the wine sell itself is probably the most important part of the buyer, I would think. You got pay wines and you got play wines, right? Pay wines are the wines that you need to carry. Your customers are going to ask for, and if you don't carry them, they're going to go somewhere else to find them. And there are a lot of examples of those. Kendall Jackson Chardonnay, best-selling Chardonnay in the United States, 25 years. That's a pay wine. That's a wine that retailers need to carry. Customers are going to ask for it. If you don't have it, they're going to go somewhere else. And then you've got these play wines, which are what, unfortunately, I think too many buyers and too many sommeliers get, they fall in love with, are these obscure, boutique-y, esoteric, weird wines that are totally cool and great to talk about, but people have the tendency to fill their entire department with them. And then at the end, every single bottle of wine you're going to sell requires a half-hour dissertation about it. At the end of all that, people are going to say, well, hey, I just want some Kendall Jackson Chardonnay.
The dissertations, you know, are the things that got me. I would sit there and listen to you talk to some of the clients, and they would come to you and say, we're looking for a Merlot that finishes like this, and it has this oaky and this different. I mean, listening to all that, it loses me right away. But then my head goes to, how much does any of this really matter to somebody that's buying it?
I'd say it matters as much as they're asking, right? And a lot of people, I think, ask for things that maybe they're ingrained in asking. Maybe they're trained to ask you for a dry, oaky red wine, when in fact, in their mind, when they taste something that actually has a little bit of sweetness, that's what they want. But they're trained to ask you for one thing or another.
Well, what trains them to ask that? I mean, if they're asking the wrong thing and then they get the wrong wine, they're going to say the sommelier doesn't know what he's talking about. And then
and that's the trick, man. Just reading. You got to read people.
The movie Sideways, you told me the story about how it almost, it basically crippled Merlot for a while. We talk about that. Well, why did that happen? Why would that have an impact on pop culture?
Right? So people in general are sheep, right?
Sure. Yep.
About everything. Mm-hmm. So this movie came out, and I really liked the movie, but it involved two guys that were two buddies. One of them was getting engaged, and they were going to go out to wine country and sort of sow their wild oats while they were gone for the weekend. And the one buddy was the wine geek of the group, and he, throughout the movie, really liked to sort of poeticize the intricacies and everything that was great about Pinot Noir, and did a great job of doing so. And
was it accurate?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he made very valid points about Pinot Noir, and he was in Santa Barbara County. The movie was based in Santa Barbara County, and that is, about as far south as you're growing grapes in Cali, and one of the most idyllic places in California, if not the most, for Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. So made sense that they were there talking about that. And at the same time, he had this huge problem with drinking Merlot or Merlot-based wines. That wasn't discussed as in-depth. Never really talked about why or why not, but that big Holy Grail bottle of Cheval Blanc he drank at the end of the movie is majority Merlot. And Cabernet Franc. So it was
a matter of people just hearing this theme throughout the movie that this guy, educated wine snob, like Merlot, and you know, you've got real life consequences that.
And at that time, yeah, it was kind of cool to bash on Merlot because it was the in style grape, if you will. So what happens when something is in style? It's supply and demand, right? People rush to fill a demand, and in fine wine, there's no rushing anything. That's the antithesis of fine wine, is rushing something. So people had these vineyards that were planted to whatever, let's say Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, whatever, and ripped vines out in a rush to plant Merlot and fill this void, and in the end ripped out some really beautiful vineyards of other varietals and planted some really shitty places to grow Merlot. you know.
Right, to make the demand.
To try to, yeah. So you lost a lot of beautiful Chard, Pinot, whatever, and were replaced with seas and seas of mediocre, crappy Merlot to fill a demand. And the other thing that, you know, about Pinot is very site-specific and picky and a hard grape to grow. So when you over-farm it and you plant it in places that it doesn't belong, it loses out and everything that's good about it. It's just kind of it's lost.
One of the things, too, I think about that movie was when he was talking about, obviously, the different wines, but then they were eating and then trying to pair the... That's another unique thing that sommeliers and people in the wine industry have to know as well. I mean, pairing it with food, that's a challenge.
A sommelier really works in a dining room. Their job is to work in a high-end restaurant, and pair wines from their cellar with the food that you order.
Well, it sounds like you're almost titling something that, you know, you have a passion for it, and you've studied and you've worked hard to learn about it, and you're quick to share your education with it. Why title it? Oh, he's a sommelier. Because that's a big deal, but it's more really, than just this title.
Well, it's because it's really the only certification in our industry that gives any validity to your knowledge. You know, anyone can, and I'm not pretending to be the end-all, be-all, whatever. I mean, I always say, the more you learn about wine, the more you realize you don't know shit, right? But the SOM certification is a good stepping stone, if you will. At least it gives some validity to your knowledge, right?
Right. You've done different wine dinners and wine shows and just different classes and things like that, where pairing foods and cheeses is a big deal. Where do you polish that? Where do you learn all that to know that a steak goes with this wine, or fish goes with this wine, or this particular cheese is going to go good with this wine?
I would say, most importantly, if you have a doubt or you're trying to figure out how to pair something, pair a wine with something or a spirit with something, pair it regionally. So if you're talking about spaghetti bolognese and meatballs, what do I pair with that? Well, I would probably think about what people in Tuscany eat or drink with spaghetti and meatballs, or mm-hmm. with bolognese and meatballs, mm-hmm. right? Because they've been doing it for thousands of years. It's no accident that the wines that they make and the wines that they drink with those foods taste really good together, because they've done it. I mean, it's not an accident. So pair it regionally. I mean, you're in the southwest of France, right? You're in Sancerre. You're in the Loire Valley. Where are you? You're on the Atlantic coast. What are you eating? Shellfish, oysters, clams, crab, shrimp. What tastes good with that? Those cool climate white wine, white varietals that grow there magically taste really good with that shit, right?
Right. I mean, that's
it's not an accident.
Right. Don't try to reinvent the wheel.
Don't reinvent the wheel, man. When in France, you know, when in Rome.
There you go.
There you go.
Yeah. I was hoping you would fix that. When in France, I don't mess with France. Thanks. That's all.
Not on the Salmena show.
Not on the Salmena show.
No.
You had an event last week, the SOM Slam, you did with a good friend of friend of mine, yep. Michael Krieger.
Crispy Kriegs.
How was that? To me, the concept of that is really neat. I mean, it's got to be a really cool night out for the people at the show, and it's got to be cool for you guys, too.
It's a lot of fun. So the basic idea behind a SOM Slam is pair two wine professionals and let them pair wines blind to the judge or the customer of the event, and basically see who garners the most votes. So Chef Victoria gave us a menu the week before the event, a very awesome menu, very classic menu, with a price point, and Michael and I were allowed to pick a wine to go with each course. So as the event started, customers sat down to lobster mac and cheese made right in front of everyone in the demo kitchen at Victoria's with Chef Victoria with smoked Gouda. It was awesome. And Michael and I each planned a wine with that course, and we did the same with all four courses. And then after that, the audience picked two. Who made the better pairing? So we tied 2-2.
2-2. How diplomatic.
Yeah.
You really won, though.
Well,
Go ahead. It's okay. There's no need to be humble.
No, we tied 2-2.
Okay. You're such
so a, there's a repeat.
You're a dip. Oh, so there's round two.
Round two's coming.
Nice.
And a dog walk his ass. He's getting dog walked.
It's going down, Michael.
He's getting dog walked.
The explosion of wine sales with the younger generation. I mean, pretty much our generation and on. I mean, wine has become so much more mainstream, and wine sales have just increased so much. The internet has done something really neat to that, where you've got these wine clubs and these subscription clubs, Wink, and you know some of these other ones, that they'll send you the wines that you like, and you just do a quick questionnaire and answer these questions, and they'll send you the wines that result.
Mm-hmm.
What do you've heard of these clubs? What do you think these clubs are doing? Are they here for the long haul? And do they help or hurt the industry?
I think that clubs in general like that are good for the simple fact that they start to educate our consumer. If a club like if that's what it takes to get a non-wine drinker to drink wine, at least in the beginning, then I think that that's really cool and they're great. And I think that's what they do. I don't know of any wine drinkers that I've ever met that get their entire cache, if you will, of wine from online wine clubs. It just doesn't happen. It seems to be sort of a segue into that lifestyle, whereas you might join and spend 6 months getting these monthly wine shipments and going, figuring out, hey, I like, I like Sangiovese from Tuscany, but wow, this Chardonnay from, from Virginia, I don't. I would say that I just like the fact that they get people into wine way or the other. Yeah. But it's not, I don't think it's a threat to, I think it's just cool for that. There's nobody relying on them to, bring them their entire stash.
So there's got to be people selecting the wines that work there behind the scenes. That would be someone similar to your role.
I would hope, but I don't think so. I think most of the time clubs like that focus on, there's a lot of wine made out there, and there's a lot of really cool but a lot of weird wine that really doesn't maybe have a immediate place. I think there's a lot of wine out there that has a lot of, just doesn't maybe have an immediate home, and these clubs are sort of a cool outlet for things like that, where people aren't asking for anything specific and just want to sort of explore weird things. So there's a lot of wine out there.
Yeah. And bringing it back home, I mean, Michigan's unique in that we've got a lot of sweet wines.
Mm-hmm.
Grown up north.
Yeah.
I mean, Michigan's got some good wines.
And getting better every year, absolutely. We have a really quick growing season. So I think when people are quick to judge Michigan wines and they say that we don't make quote unquote good wine or whatever, I think they're not really judging the region for what it's capable of. Somebody sent me an email one time and it said, don't judge a fish by how well it climbs a tree. If you judge a fish by how well it climbs a tree, you're going to think there's a lot of stupid fish out there, right?
Sure.
But if you can associate our region with the good things that it can do, you will see that Michigan is great at growing grapes, and we make some really kick-ass wines that are getting better every year.
Is it more because Michigan's just now starting, or has it been just something that was stale and stagnant, and now there's been a big push to improve?
I just think it's people opening their ears, that's all. I mean, the people that are quick to say that, and I'm not, I don't sell any wines from Michigan, and I'm not trying to be a spokesman of Michigan, but I live here, and I'll just tell you the way I think it. The people that are first to talk trash about Michigan wines are the ones that are the kind of people that only drink, Napa Valley Cabernet. And they're the people that drive up to the old Mission Peninsula in July on vacation with their wife and kids, like most of us do, and decide, hey, we should go see the wineries, and get pissed off and discount these wineries because they don't grow kick-ass Napa Valley Cabernet. Well, go out to Napa Valley and try to find a winery that grows kick-ass cool climate Riesling or Gewürztraminer, right? Maybe some of them do, but you have to appreciate a region for what it can do. So
you would pair a Michigan Riesling with a Coney?
Shit, with Coneys? No, I like thin skin rustic reds, maybe like a Gamay, maybe Cru Beaujolais, like Fleury or Margon or some kind of, you know, maybe some funky Southern Italian red varietals, but yeah, for sure.
Because nothing.
No, I'm not going Riesling with Coney's. No.
Nothing says fine wine.
I'm gonna say Cru Beaujolais and Coney's.
Only at 3:30 in the morning on Hall Road.
Oh, for the win, baby! For sure.
For the win.
And one of my favorite pairings, Miller High Life, baby.
with anything.
Miller High Life with anything. Especially Coney's.
As we sit here drinking Belgium's finest.
And lots of them. Yeah.
We pop in bottles tonight. Do you ever get tired of wine?
Yes. Very temporarily. But yes.
Because it greases your wallet. You can't get tired
of it. No. It's got nothing to do with that. Nothing to do with that. I get burned out on wine.
As we sat here for an hour tonight.
More often than you think I would. We could crack a bottle of something and I'd probably have a glass, but these Stellas are really just fine.
They go down so nice.
Yes, sir.
So nice. What's your favorite wine and what do you eat it with?
Oh, God.
What do you drink it with?
What's your favorite wine?
Or you hate that question?
I hate that.
You've been asked
a million
times. That's the
most awful question.
All right, what's your favorite food then?
I don't like that question either.
Well, then we're done.
Tell me where I am and what I'm doing.
Okay, you're okay. All right, good. Good. I like that.
What am I doing?
It's your 20th anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys are at a fine American steakhouse.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a prime rib in front of you, mm-hmm, with a baked potato.
Mm-hmm.
What are you drinking?
I'm drinking, well, I'll tell you what I'm eating first. We're at the Capitol Grill.
Oh, we're not, okay.
We're at the Capitol Grill. Okay. I know it's a chain.
They don't sponsor this show, but that's fine. They can. Love you. You're at the Capitol Grill.
And people will laugh at me because they'll, you know, oh, that's a blah, 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 whatever.
What's wrong with the Capitol Grill?
I like the Capitol
Grill. I like the Capitol Grill, too.
I'm having a bone-in Kona-rubbed ribeye. I'm having a cup of lobster bisque with a sidecar of sherry. And I'm having truffle fries. I'm drinking some badass first, second, third, fourth growth Bordeaux, whatever that may be. Probably not first or second growth. Depends who's paying. And that's what I'm drinking, all right?
Mm-hmm. You're in Napoli, Italy, my town, with my people, and you're eating fresh fish right out of the sea.
That's a tough one, man. It's probably it's some kind of local, probably be drinking Falanghina or something.
Well, the Lagrimir, the Angel Tears.
Lacrima Christi.
Yeah.
Which is Falanghina. And
so it just all depends basically where you're at, what you're eating. You don't have a preference. You don't have a... Ted, thanks for the time. I appreciate you having me over. I appreciate the Stellas, and good luck in everything you do, and I hope to do this again. I do want to have you back in a couple weeks. We'll break down the NFL draft. Does that sound good?
Yeah, that sounds cool. Let me get my graphic. What do they call it? Template?
Yeah, sure.
Grid?
Yep, there you go.
Let me get my grid set.
Oh, bracket. No, that's basketball.
Let me get my bracket.
My, you know, bracket. That'd be something. 64 wines. All right, Ted. Thanks a lot, Ted.
You're welcome.
Okay. I want to thank Ted for having me over and for coming on the show and dropping some knowledge for us on the wine industry. Really, really misunderstood industry. If you're into wine, you're really into wine. And if you're not, you might have some feelings about people that are into wine. And it's good. I mean, it is good. I'm not going to lie. If you find a good one and you're eating good food with it. And I also want to thank Ted for some real philosophical things. The fish up the tree. I think we're going to make a poster out of that one too. I mean, that's definitely better than the teaching a man how to fish. So you can find him on Facebook. And if you also want to ask him for more inspirational quotes, I'm sure he'll be happy to share those with you too. Okay, so we're gearing up for the next one, and we're getting ready for baseball season. I know everybody's in the midst of March Madness and getting ready their mock drafts, and we'll have one of those too. But we're going to have Corey back with us. We're going to talk about baseball. We're going to talk about youth baseball again and, you know, getting ready for the seasons. And, you know, we're going to get his thoughts on Major League Baseball as well and what to expect. And like, listen, share. You can find me on Twitter at FN Geese. You can find me on Facebook as well. Do me that favor and subscribe to the podcast and leave comments and leave nice reviews. Till next time, thanks.